many of us do not receive gratitude very well. We fret over whether we deserve it. We worry about what's being expected of us, especially if we have had teachers or managers who have used gratitude as a means to spur productivity. Or we're nervous about living up to what we see as expectations behind the gratitude. Accustomed to a culture where buying, earning, and deserving are the standard modes of interchange, we are often uncomfortable with simple giving and receiving. Nonviolent communication encourages us to receive gratitude with the same quality of empathy we express when listening to any message. We hear what we've done that's contributed to the other's well-being. We hear their feelings and the needs that were fulfilled. We take into our hearts the joyous reality that we can each enhance the quality of others' lives. I was taught to receive appreciation with grace by my friend Nafez Asseli. He was a member of a Palestinian team whom I had invited to Switzerland for training in nonviolent communication. At the end of the workshop, Nafez came up to me, said, "This training will be very valuable for us in working for peace in my country." He said, "I would like to thank you in a way that we Sufis do when we want to express special appreciation for something." Locking his thumb onto mine, he looked me in the eye and said, "I kiss the God in you that allows you to give us what you did." He then kissed my hand. Nafez's expression of gratitude showed me a different way to receive gratitude. Usually it's received from one of two polar positions. At one end, what we call egotism, believing ourselves to be superior because we've been given this gratitude. At the other extreme is false humility, denying the importance of the appreciation by shrugging it off and saying things, "Oh, it's nothing." Nafez showed me that I could receive appreciation and gratitude joyfully in the awareness that what I had been given enabled me to enrich the lives of others. If I am aware that it is this power of a divine energy working through each of us that gives us the power to enrich lives for others, then I would avoid the ego trap and the false humility poles. Golda Meir, when she was the Israeli prime minister, once chided one of her ministers who couldn't receive the gratitude except to try to be humble about it. She said, "Don't be so humble. You're not that great." The following lines that I read in a book by Marianne Williamson serve as another reminder for me to avoid the pitfall of false humility. It also helps me to understand why so many people have fear receiving gratitude. In her book, she writes, "Our deepest fear is not that we are inadequate. Our deepest fear is that we are powerful beyond measure. It is our light, not our darkness, that frightens us. You are a child of God. Your playing small doesn't serve the world. There's nothing enlightened about shrinking so that other people won't feel insecure around you. We were born to make manifest the glory of God that is within us. It's not just in some of us, it is in everyone. And as we let our own light shine, we consciously give other people permission to do the same. As we are liberated from our fear, our presence automatically liberates others." Paradoxically, despite our unease in receiving gratitude, most of us yearn to be genuinely recognized for what we have done. During a surprise party for me, a 12-year-old friend of mine suggested a party game to help introduce the guests to each other. We were to write down a question, drop it in a box, and then take turns with each person drawing out a question and responding to it out loud. Having recently consulted with various social service agencies and industrial organizations, I was feeling struck by how often people expressed a hunger for gratitude being expressed on their jobs. I heard over and over variations on the theme, "No matter how hard you work, you never hear a good word from anybody, but make one mistake and there's always somebody jumping all over you." So for this game that was suggested, I wrote the question, "What gratitude might someone express that would leave you jumping for joy?" A woman drew that question out of the box, read it, and started to cry. as director of a shelter for battered women, she would put considerable energy each month into creating a schedule to please as many staff members as possible. Yet each time the schedule was presented, at least a couple of individuals would complain. She couldn't remember ever receiving gratitude for her efforts to design a fair schedule. All this had flashed through her mind as she read my question, and the hunger for gratitude brought tears to her eyes. Upon hearing the woman's story, another friend of mine said that he too would like to answer that question. Everyone else then also wanted to take a turn. As they responded to the question, several people wept. While the craving for gratitude, as opposed to manipulative praise and compliments, is particularly evident in the workplace, it affects family life as well. One evening when I pointed out this failure to perform a house chore, my son Brett retorted, "Dad, are you aware how often you bring up what's going wrong but almost never bring up what's gone right?" His observation stayed with me. I realized how I was continually searching for improvements, while too infrequently stopping to celebrate things that were going as I would like. I had just completed a workshop with over 100 participants, all of whom had evaluated it very highly with the exception of one person. However, what lingered in my mind was what that one person had written. That evening, as I deliberated on how often it's the things we have not done that we would like to have done that stay with us, rather than celebrating what we did do, I wrote a song that began, "If I'm 98% perfect on anything I do, it's the 2% I've messed up I'll remember when I'm through." It occurred to me that I had a choice to adopt instead the outlook of a teacher I knew. One of her students, having neglected to study for an exam, had resigned himself to turning in a blank piece of paper with his name at the top. He was surprised when she later returned the test to him with a grade of 14%. "What did I get 14% for?" he asked incredulously. "Neatness," she replied. Ever since my son Brett's wake-up call, I've tried to be more aware of what others are doing that enriches my life and to make sure that it gets expressed. I was deeply touched by a passage in John Powell's book, The Secret of Staying in Love, in which he describes his sadness over having been unable during his father's lifetime to express the gratitude he felt for him. How sad it seemed to me to miss the chance of expressing gratitude to the people who have been the greatest positive influences in our lives. Immediately an uncle of mine, Julius Fox, came to mind. When I was a boy, he came daily to offer nursing care to my grandmother, who was totally paralyzed. While he cared for my grandmother, he always had a warm and loving smile on his face. No matter how unpleasant the task may have appeared to my boyish eyes, he treated her as if she were doing him the greatest favor she could do by letting him take care of her. This provided a wonderful model of masculine strength for me, one that I've often called upon in the years since. I realized that I had never expressed my gratitude to him. And now I realize that he was now ill and near death. I considered to express my gratitude, but sensed my resistance. I said to myself, "I'm sure he already knows how much he means to me. I don't need to express it out loud. Besides, it might embarrass him if I put it into words." As soon as these thoughts entered my head, I knew they weren't true. Too often I had assumed that others knew the intensity of my gratitude only to discover otherwise. And even when people were embarrassed, they still wanted to hear the gratitude verbalized. Still hesitant, I told myself that words wouldn't do justice to the depth of what I wished to communicate. I quickly saw through that one, though. Yes, words may be poor vehicles in conveying our heartfelt realities, but as I have learned, anything that's worth doing is worth doing poorly. As it happened, I soon found myself seated next to Uncle Julius at a family gathering, and the words simply flowed out of me. He took them in joyfully, without embarrassment. Brimming over with feelings from the evening, I went home, composed a poem, and sent it to him. I was later told that, After receiving my poem, he asked that it be read to him each of the following days until he died 3 weeks later. I once asked this uncle how he had developed such a remarkable capacity to give compassionately. He seemed honored by my question, which he pondered before replying, and then he said, "I've been blessed with good teachers." When I asked who they were, he said, "Well, your grandmother was the best teacher I had. You lived with her when she was already ill, so you didn't know what she was really like. For example, did your mother ever tell you about the time during the Depression when she brought a tailor and his wife and two children to live with the family for 3 years, after he had lost his house and business in the Depression? I remembered that story well. It had left a deep impression when my mother first told it to me, because I could never figure out where grandmother had found space for the Taylor's family when she was raising 9 children of her own in a pretty small house." Uncle Julius recollected my grandmother's compassion in a few more anecdotes, all of which I had heard as a child. Then he asked, "Well, then, surely your mother told you about Jesus." I said, "About who?" "Jesus." I said, "No, Uncle Julius, she never told me about Jesus." The story about Jesus was the final precious gift I received from my uncle before he died. It's a true story of a time when a man came to my grandmother's back door asking for some food. This wasn't unusual. Although grandmother was very poor, the entire neighborhood knew that she would feed anyone who showed up at her door. The man who came to the door had a beard and wild, scraggly black hair. His clothes were ragged, and he wore a cross around his neck fashioned out of branches tied with a rope. My grandmother invited him into her kitchen for some food. While he was eating, she asked his name. He replied, "My name is Jesus." She asked, "Do you have a last name?" "I'm Jesus the Lord." My grandmother's English wasn't too good. Another uncle came in the room while this man was still eating, and grandmother introduced the stranger as Mr. the Lord. As he continued to eat, my grandmother asked where he lived, and he replied, "I don't have a home." She asked, "Well, where are you going to stay tonight? It's cold." He said, "I don't know." She said, "Would you like to stay here?" He stayed 7 years. I called my mother that night, and I said, "Mother, why did you never tell me the story about Jesus?" My mother said, "Oh, my goodness, there was a story like that every day I could tell you about your grandmother. I thought I had told you that one." When it came to communicating nonviolently, my grandmother was a natural. She didn't think of what this man was. If she did, she probably would have judged him as crazy and gotten rid of him. No, my grandmother thought in terms of what people feel and what they need. If they're hungry, feed them. If they're without a roof over their head, give them a place to sleep. One other thing I'd like to tell you about my grandmother. She loved to dance. And my mother remembers her saying often, "Never walk when you can dance." I would like to end this program on nonviolence and compassion with a poem I wrote about my grandmother after talking to my uncle that night. I wrote it in honor of my grandmother, who spoke and lived naturally the language of nonviolent communication. One day a man named Jesus came around to my grandmother's door. He asked for a little food. She gave him more. He said he was Jesus the Lord. She didn't check him out with Rome. He stayed for several years, as many did, without a home. It was in her Jewish way. She taught me what Jesus had to say. In that precious way, she taught me what Jesus had to say. And that's, feed the hungry, heal the sick, then take a rest. Never walk when you can dance. Make your home a cozy nest. Yes, it was in her Jewish way. She taught me what Jesus had to say. In her precious way, she taught me what Jesus had to say.
This concludes Nonviolent Communication, A Language of Life with Marshall Rosenberg. Music by Stephen McNamara. For more information on the work of Marshall Rosenberg, please contact him via www.nonviolentcommunication.com. If you would like additional copies of this audio learning series, or to receive a free catalog of audio, video, and music for the inner life, please visit Sounds True on the World Wide Web, www.soundstrue.com, or call 1-800-333-9185, or write the Sounds True catalog, P.O. Box 8010, Boulder, Colorado, 80306. Thank you for listening.